stretch a little, see what your how your body is, and then we'll get buckled in for this. So, I don't know. And my chair that I sit in squeaks a little bit. So, I apologize if there's a few squeaking sounds from time to time that might disturb you. I hope they don't. You look like you've all stretched as much as you're gonna stretch at home, almost. China's still got a few stretches in her. That's good. I think that we should do the before lecture chant. Why don't we do that? An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Well, I think you probably mostly know I'm here because Norman had a surprise visitation from his family, and his family from the East Coast, and so they're off gallivanting, I think, doing whatever. Hope they're having a good time. And he asked me if I would fill in. So I am. It's my pleasure. And he did want me to check back on the homework. So the homework from last week was, and these are his words, see if you can practice recollection of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha every day this week. Just bring up the words and whatever ideas or images you have about them in your zazen or some other time. This is a traditional practice. Also, practice mindfulness of the body. Be aware of the body and breathing as much as you can. So that's the homework. I wonder, he wanted how to go. And Shufi, would you, if people raise their digital hands or you'll call on people, how did it go? Did you do this? Well, I'll raise my hand. I did. I do, actually. I've been doing this for some time, and I just ran. I don't do it necessarily. Well, I always take refuge when I sit down for my morning zazen, but I do it randomly, walking around, in my day, and I just think, take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And maybe just sit with that, just or walk with that, or whatever I'm doing if I'm at the store, to let it sink in that we're. I'm taking refuge. I give it all over. Everything is offered over, and I can be open to whatever arises. We're not separate, and I find it helpful when I remember. It really helps if I remember to do it in a meeting because I'm not. I don't love meetings and I don't always have good behavior. So that it's a really good time to do it. So anybody else? I see China's got a hand. There's a couple. Let's do these few hands. Go ahead, Shufi.
Jane.
And then China put up a regular hand.
This is one of those things that when I heard it, I went, "What a great idea." And I think it's going to need to be one of those things that I put up a post-it for or do some kind of, real anchoring of this idea so that I really do make it happen and really take it in. So I've really appreciated the homeworks in general for this study. And I think that they each are ways to keep practice in my daily life, really keep practice happening outside of Zazen. So I'll try harder.
Ha
China, go ahead.
There, unmute. Okay, thank you. Just briefly, during our morning sits, because I, like Jane, thought, oh, what a great idea. And then I promptly forgot in general. But when I do remember it, it's often in our morning sit. And I think of, I guess it's the language of the Lotus Sutra, but imagining all of us, with these billions of bodies and Buddhas inside of each cell, that fantastic cosmology of the Lotus Sutra. When we're all sitting there together concentrated, or like just now, though I didn't remember it just now, but imagining that many Buddhas really lifts my heart. Whether I'll meet them on the street or have to keep cultivating them in my own mind and heart, it brings me joy. Thank you.
Philip.
One thing that's been alive for me this week is in regard to just to the notion of Sangha, lectures that Suzuki Roshi gave at the beginning of 1971, his last year of life. I've been reading these lectures, and this week in particular, in regard to the Dharma homework. Thinking about Sangha, he emphasizes in almost every one of these several lectures, including a session, a 7-day session that took place during this time, that we're not doing group practice. And for me, just casually thinking about the notion of Sangha, I think of that being, in a way, the essence of group practice, or something that's a feature of it. And it's something I've been struggling with because it's not clear to me exactly what Suzuki Roshi means by we practice with each other, but it's not group practice. And he says it so many times that, in a way, it's obvious that we're sitting, we sit together on our cushions, but it's certainly not something that the sitting itself is not a group activity, despite the fact that it receives support from each other and encouragement. But it's a Seems to me that what he's talking about in this lecture is the effort, the individual effort we make. And he emphasizes that it's not group practice because we practice with everything. We practice with mountains and rivers and stones, and that this is the effort that we're making the reality of our sitting. So I don't have any clarification of that so much as just something holding to that, like kind of like a poem, the notion of our practice not being group practice, but we practice, but it entails our practicing with one another. So that's all kind of a jumble, but thank you.
One more.
Paula.
Hi, everyone. I hesitated raising my hand because what I was going to share feels a little silly. But it did pop up in my head when I was thinking about the homework. So, what the heck? I will share it. I thought about the Dr. Seuss story of the Grinch. And because I read it to my kids, and I thought of myself as the Grinch, and having all of these ideas about different things and how things should be and should not be. And the Grinch kind of learns with the Sangha, like the Who, that it was okay all along. It didn't matter. They didn't have the gifts, and they had each other, and they had this interconnectedness between one another, and his heart grew 10 times. And I just felt like that's what we're doing, is we're growing our hearts like the Grinch, with the Dharma. And so Buddha, Dharma, Sangha kind of felt like Dr. Seuss was speaking about that with that story. So that was all. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you. And the Grinch is perfect for today, actually. So let's get started. Today we're moving on. Well, I need to say first, I'm not an expert, right, on the Dhammapada. I've been attending class like you. And then about a week and a half ago, Norman asked if I would do this. So I've been like doubling down and really trying to study. And I have to say that AI has helped me a bit. I've used it to try to understand some things. And so I'm just going to share what I've learned as we go through. We're going to go through all the verses in the two chapters. Now, the two chapters, the first one is 21, hell. I thought, hell? Oh my. And then the second one is 22, the elephant. Oh no, it's 22 and 23. 22 is hell, 23 is the elephant. Anyway, hell, I want to talk a little bit about hell. And I think the Grinch is great because, in my mind, I think the Grinch at the start of that story is in the Grinch's own Grinchy sort of hell. Because basically, as I see hell, it's a separation. When we do acts, when we do actions that have karmic results that result in us being in hell, it's usually because we imagine we're a separate self. We're not connected to others. And finally, the Grinch gets that wow, we're connected. And I don't have to grasp things or push stuff away. There can just be love. So I think the Grinch is great for this particular study. Now, I was interested in how the early Buddhists thought about hell, and they didn't think it was eternal. It's sort of only you're there until the negative karma is exhausted. And they did have a lot of descriptions of various hells, like boiling hells, hot hells, maybe 10 different kinds of hot hells, and maybe 10 different kinds of freezing cold hells. While they are described as a physical location, they're actually interpreted as states of mind that represent the immense suffering caused by unwholesome actions. So then, I looked up, well, what did hell mean to Zen, our Zen ancestors? I was curious about that. And hell was generally understood not as an eternal place of punishment, but rather as a state of mind, self-created reality born from intense negative emotions like anger, hatred, greed, ignorance, which trap us in this cycle of suffering. So it's, the three poisons, right? Greed, hatred, and delusion. Well, I've already talked a little bit about my sense of hell. Then I kind of got going on, I got going on different kinds of hells because, there's all these different ones, cold, freezing hells and hot hells. And I started to imagine, well, what might that be? And I was thinking, well, gosh, cold hells, if you're in a cold hell, maybe I'm numb sometimes. Maybe I'm disconnected. I'm not feeling anything. Maybe it's hard to feel empathic. I think there are persons who can't feel empathic and they don't know it. And that might be a really cold hell to be in because you just can't connect. And so everything you might try to do doesn't satisfy. You grasp and grasp. And then that made me think of the sort of the hell of the hungry ghosts, you know, where they try to eat but it can't fill their bellies. I've been in that place. Years and years ago, I felt like I was in a hungry ghost hell. And actually, it was coming to practice, coming and sitting on the cushion, that helped me realize I didn't have to grasp from outside. I could, it was all here with me all the time. I have a particular hell that I go to, or that I experience physically. And I'm saying these because I want you to maybe think about hells and how you experience them in your body. Because we do. Our thoughts, our feelings affect our bodies. And for me, when I've done something, I've been disconnected. You're not I've forgotten that I'm not a separate, that I'm not a separate self. I forget my interconnection. And I've done something for which I feel ashamed or bad. Then the kind of hell I'm in, I feel this heavy weight pressing down on me. And it's very physical. I call that, and so I think that's heavyweight hell, you know? And I really feel it, and I have to get on the cushion. I have to sit and breathe and be kind and notice what got stirred up? What were the little young parts perhaps in myself? Listen to them, and what do I need to do to make amends, you know? And eventually I can work through it, but it's a very heavy feeling. And it's agitated. So these are just some examples. Have fun with hells, you know. I encourage it, you know. And thinking how you experience it, and what actions and what states of mind bring this about. Okay. Well, now we're actually going to get into the sutra, and I did want to tell you, you know, in my research of the. I researched online, and I discovered that most of these verses, they weren't originally, you know, written down in order, I don't think. They all came from particular incidences, stories. And you can look them up. There's whole collections of, some are shorter and some are really long stories, for each of these verses. I didn't go too far in it because I didn't have the time and I wasn't sure I could check the sources and properly understand if they were really correct or not. So I'm not going to really share most of that. But you could go and find that, and it would give a further depth. Just knowing that gives me a further depth to this study, because it means these verses were alive in the time of Buddha and they had a purpose. You know, for particular people, and they're universal. Let's see. I wanted to say, Bhikkhu Bodhi, speaking about unwholesome karma, and says it's actions rooted in mental states of greed, hatred, and delusion. And these are temptations, these actions that many of us could experience at one time or another. And that it's important to notice in ourselves what's underlying a particular action that we take. So that, I want you to just keep that in mind as we go through these verses. So now, we'll start at verse 306. Those who assert what is not true go to hell, as do those who deny what they've done. Both these people of base deeds become equal after death in the world beyond. So lying's lying, right? Whatever type of lying, from whatever reason, you're going to be in a bad state. When I was growing up, to tell a lie was the worst thing I could do. I would be punished for that more than for anything else. That my parents were really clear on that. The good side about it was that if I was truthful, they trusted me. And so actually I had a lot of freedom growing up. So there's a real relationship between truthfulness and freedom. I rem after reading this verse, I thought of it jumped in my mind this quote. I'm sure you'll recognize it. It's not from the Buddha. It's, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." A lot of people think that Shakespeare said that, but he didn't. It was a line from Sir Walter Scott's 1808 epic poem, Marmion. And I like it. I've thought of that for years when I'm tempted to begin to speak untruthfully or to maybe just hide something a little bit or whatever. I can just see the whole web I'll have to of unreality I'll have to keep going. And that feels like the pressing down hell, even before I do it. So I don't do it. Usually, I'm sure I'm not perfect that way. So, but I think it helps to have little phrases sometimes that help us remember. Oh, yeah, if I do that, oh, yeah. And I also think about how sad it is when we say something that's not true or deny something we've done. We're trying to protect ourselves, but it means we must feel pretty small inside. And so if we're feeling small, we need to look at that and be kind to that inside smallness to help it. All right, the next one. Many who wear the saffron robe have evil traits and lack restraint. By their evil deeds are these wicked people reborn in hell. Well, having taken vows doesn't really protect a person from mistaken views or craving, or the internal pain of just being feeling disconnected. Well, I was wondering what evil means here. So I used AI. It's basically defined in terms of the Dhammapada as morally wrong conduct, acts of body, speech, and mind. And it comes from greed, hatred, and delusion, as we've said. So that's, and then it's, we, in terms of evil, the text emphasizes that it's, we're purified or defiled by our own actions, not some external force. And then I was, good in Buddhism, I think rather than thinking of good or evil, I like to think of wholesome and unwholesome. Because I think in evil we've got, the word evil has a big overlay in English anyway of history and just what we think that might mean. So for me it's always helpful to think, is this action, is this thought wholesome or unwholesome? Does it harm someone else, myself or others, or is it somehow helpful? I'm going on to verse 308. I really like this verse. It's better to eat a flaming red hot iron ball than to be an immoral and unrestrained person feeding on the alms food of the people. I love that imagery. I can just, wow, that's what it's like when we do actions that are disconnected from one another, from, and not just one another as people, from the whole of creation, all creatures, you know, and we kind of can see that in our world. It's like, it's so destructive. You would be better off if you just swallow a red hot flaming iron ball. You'd be better off. Well, and then it's better off than the unrestrained person feeding on the alms food of the people. This is like actions where we put ourselves first and basically take what's not given. You know, it's stealing. It's like in the precepts where you're taking what's not given. Or in this case, maybe of the monks of the time, they're given food, but they're not practicing as the people who are giving them the food are hoping, because they're trying to support them in their practice, and in fact they're not. So it's taking what is not given. So, and that's a really, according to this, pretty awful thing to do. Verse 309 and 310. Four results come to the careless person who consorts with the spouse of another. Demerit, disturbed sleep, disgrace, and hell. For the frightened pair, delight is brief, and then come demerit, rebirth in an evil state, and harsh punishment from the king. Therefore, a person should not consort with another's spouse. Oh, well, first, I'm thinking of the word the careless person, and in the other translation, the Thanissaro Bhikkhu translation, he says heedless. They're similar, careless or heedless, not paying attention. You're only thinking of yourself and your own needs being met. And it may, in that moment, you're heedless. You've X'd out the other. Then the next interesting thing to me in this is that the pair are frightened. They're characterized as frightened. And I think that's because you know that you're not being honest somehow. There's, again, that dishonesty. There's disconnection. And there's always fear of being found out. But this is a hard one because we're human beings, right? We've got really strong hormones and desire and endorphins and craving, and maybe we're in a bad relationship and somebody is really, seems like they really are gonna just listen to us and do it for us. And you can understand how a person would fall into that. I can personally understand how that could happen. Thinking back to my very much younger years, but it never felt that there was nothing good that ever came of it. We have to wall off a part of ourselves. Do you ever feel like you do that? In order to do something you really want, or if you're craving something, you've got to wall something off, some essential part of yourself. I think he doesn't say it in so many words, but I think that's the hell that you get into. So maybe we're not sleeping with somebody else's partner. I'm a good girl. I've been married for 30-something years. I haven't done that. But at the same time, maybe I have walled off to people, to other people in some ways. So maybe we, in our lives, we have to expand this a little bit. You know, so we don't just say, oh, well, I'm good. Okay, I don't have to worry about that one. But thinking a bit more is how, are we heedful? Do we care, connect, or are we walled off? Okay, I'm going to go on. Verse 311. Just as kusa grass cuts the hand that wrongly grasps it, so the renunciant life, if wrongly grasped, drags one down to hell. I wanted to find out about kusa grass. I wonder if it's the same as, we have a grass up here along the Russian River in Sonoma County, that if you, it grows along the river, if you grab it and you're not careful, you will just shred your hand. So I think that might be the same. You have to really pay attention. You have to know this grass. So I looked it up, and the clump of kusa grass is a symbol of hope, sort of. It suggests the suggesting in the pursuit of a goal, a person may need to examine their surroundings carefully, be alert, pay attention to uncover clues or signs, or in, because like examine carefully so you know how to grasp this. It's a metaphor that highlights the importance of observation in nature, in spiritual and personal journeys. So the renunciate life, if wrongly grasped, well, we're endeavoring to live a spiritual life, right? We're here, we practice, we're doing our best. I wonder what it, what does it mean to wrongly grasp that? And what does it mean to that can drag a person down to hell? Maybe wrongly grasping it is to have some idea of what we, of attainment, of getting somewhere. I mean, it's hard not to have ideas of attainment, isn't it? It's hard not to want to get somewhere, but we have to know that our ideas, whatever idea we have, is going to be wrong. And we have to then open our hands and let it go. Because otherwise we'll be grasping and we'll be cutting ourselves, we'll be hurting ourselves. And we won't be able to move along, or not move along, we won't find our true life. The next one is a lax act, a corrupt practice, or chaste life lived dubiously doesn't bear much fruit. With steady effort, one should do what is to be done, because the lax renunciant stirs up even more dust. So again, I think these are emphasizing just stay steady. For me, get up early enough in the morning so I can sit. Stay steady. Whether I think, oh, it's any great thing or not, just get up and do it. Steady effort, doing what's to be done. When I'm lax, well, then I forget. I forget that we're all interconnected. I forget as I'm going through my day. I get more wound up. And then he says the lax renunciant stirs up even more dust. And that dust refers to greed, hate, and delusion. So it's really important that we do our practice. Continue as you are to sit. To talk to the teacher, to talk to people in the Sangha, to come to class. Well, okay, the next, moving on, I'm moving right on because there are a lot of these verses. 3:14, a foul deed is best not done. The foul deed torments one later. A good deed, for having done it, one has no regret. Well, when I first saw that, a foul deed, I thought of a foul smell. And I thought of a time in a Dharma talk years ago that Chris Fortin gave up here at Dharma Heart's End. I think she was probably talking about one of the precepts. And she said, smell your thoughts. Smell your thoughts. And that is so helpful. Because especially when, for me, because I talk a lot impulsively sometimes, and it makes me know, step back, smell this thought, smell this thing I want to say. Does it have a good smell? Or maybe not so great? And if it doesn't smell so good, or you're not sure, don't do it or say it. And if it's just a thought, well, examine it. What is it? What's going on here? Because if I go ahead impulsively and do something, well, that's when I do get tormented later in one of my various personal hells. And, of course, a good deed is best done for having done it. You know, when you do something just right from the center And there's no regret, and you can tell that. There's nothing left over, right? There's nothing left over. It's done, nothing left over. So I just would ask you for, in your mind, over the, you know, just think as you, as we're going through this, think back on something you've done that you regret. Yeah, he knows what he's talking about, doesn't he? And maybe think of a time when you have done something that was really just really right on, connected to the situation or the person. And let yourself feel the contrast. You can feel it. It's not an intellectual construct. It's something you know. So going on, just as the fortified city is guarded inside and out, so guard yourself. Don't let a moment pass you by. Those who let the moment pass grieve when they're consigned to hell. And when I read that, I don't know if you have read the Harry Potter stories or seen the movies, but I've kind of been addicted to them and so read them multiple times and seen the movies multiple times. And there's this character, Mad-Eye Moody, who's he's a wizard who goes looking for bad wizards, basically, to, and he's one of his lines is constant vigilance. So I just think of Mad-Eye with his eye that twirls around in his head and he can see behind him and all around. And this little verse reminds me of him. But really, just pay attention. Pay attention. Think of Mad-Eye. Because moments, you know, our lives are short. I feel that more and more, right? I'm getting older, and don't let these moments pass you by. For me, I'm reading a note that I wrote by hand, and it's a little hard to see, but I think it's important. Sometimes I, more than doing something rotten, sometimes I don't do something that would have been good to do. I let a moment pass by when maybe if I just said hello to somebody, or I know somebody needs a phone call, I get shy, I don't do it, I feel afraid, you know? Those for me are the moments that I let pass by and something's lost. That's one of my resolves, is to be more courageous there and remind myself, just do it, make the call, you know, check on the person, say the kind word, whatever it is. It's really hard for me. You know, I hate making phone calls. And but sometimes it's really good to do. Okay, we're going to go on. Verse 3:16. Ashamed of what's not shameful and not ashamed of what is, those who take up wrong views go to a bad rebirth. The note I wrote next to this was, well, don't believe everything you think. Sometimes our thinking is upside down, right? I might, you know, really pay attention. Take time to consider. Be curious. The next verse says, seeing danger in what's not dangerous and not seeing danger in what is, those who take up wrong views go to a bad rebirth. I'm going to read two more. Finding fault in what's not at fault and seeing no fault in what is, those who take up wrong views go to a bad rebirth. But knowing fault as fault and the faultless as the faultless, those who take up right views go to a good rebirth. So I was thinking about right view. I think this is really, how do we discriminate? And, you know, right or wholesome view is one of the points in the Noble Eightfold Path. And I think that's what it's getting at. That's how you can tell if you're seeing things correctly, is cultivating wholesome view. And I came upon a little bit of Thich Nhat Hanh that I found in his book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, where he's talking about right or wholesome view. It's just a little paragraph. He says, our happiness and the happiness of those around us depend on our degree of right view. Touching reality deeply, knowing what is going on inside and outside ourselves, is the way to liberate ourselves from the suffering that is caused by wrong perceptions. Right view is not an ideology, a system, or even a path. It is the insight we have into the reality of life, a living insight that fills us with understanding, peace, and love. And I think he goes on later into that part of the book, talking about basically emptiness or empty of separate self, as you know, as right view, because it allows us to connect with everything. So I think that's that. Cultivating right view is the essence of this one. I mean, we could have a whole Dharma talk on that, right? So this is just like little pieces and nuggets of things. But that's the end of hell. The end of hell is really telling us, pay attention, wake up, think about your connection, what is, and right view, wholesome view in the Eightfold Path. All right, now we get to go to the next chapter, which is the elephant. And I looked up the elephant symbolism in Buddhist time, and an elephant symbolizes wisdom, strength, patience, mental discipline, the journey of taming the mind, transitioning from a wild, uncontrolled state to a calm and powerful one. The Buddha teaches in the Dhammapada that a well-trained individual, like a tamed elephant, can endure challenges and abuse without losing composure. And it highlights this part of the Dhammapada, highlights the value of patience and resilience. excuse me. The tamed elephant is often associated with meditation and learning to calm the mind and develop concentration. So let me read verses 320 and 21. As an elephant in battle endures an arrow shot from the bow, so will I endure verbal abuse. Many people indeed lack virtue. The tamed elephant is the one they take into a crowd. The tamed elephant is the one the king mounts. Best among humans is the tamed person who endures verbal abuse. Well, this endurance, forbearance. Norman's favorite for virtue is patience. He said that in various Dharma talks. And I like the word for it, forbearance, which to me feels like bearing beyond bearing, staying steady. And it's an important quality. And this last part where it says, best among humans is the tame person who endures verbal abuse. I don't think that means that we let people savage us, verbally particularly. I don't think that's what it's about. But maybe it's like we don't take, it doesn't get locked and stuck. If somebody is abusive, maybe they're mentally ill, or maybe they're really in a hell and they're saying stuff. We don't have to let it get locked and stuck in our hearts, you know. We can breathe that through and have some compassion. We might have to set a boundary, but we can breathe it through. And it reminded me of the Bodhisattva Never Disparaging, the story of Never Disparaging in the Lotus Sutra. And, you know, Never Disparaging is the Bodhisattva who's always saying, oh, you're going to be a Buddha someday. And people throw stuff at him and tell him, get out of here and get lost. And he says, he'll go move off a little, and he says, I would never disparage you. I'll never harm you. You too will be a Buddha one day. And Greg Fain has a great song, you know, a country western style song about that. So you might want to listen to it. But I think that's what this is about. Well, so let's go on because, we've got some more to go through. Excellent are tamed mules, thoroughbreds, horses of the Indus Valley, tusked elephants and great elephants, but even more excellent are people who have tamed themselves. You know, an animal can't take you to awakening, a person can't. You have to tame yourself. And Gill's footnote, let me read the next one too. Not by means of these animals could one go to that place not gone to, where a self-tamed person goes, by means of a well-tamed, disciplined self. Well, Gill's footnote is, to that place not gone to is usually understood to be nirvana or awakening. Or maybe Chris Fortin would just say alive. Maybe that's how she would characterize that. And it gives the double connotation, Gill says, of a place not yet reached and a place not reachable with any conventional ideas of progress. Like you can't get on a horse and go there. You can't, you know, steps. It's different. It's presence in each moment. And self-tamed emphasizes that while a teacher and sangha get one going, ultimately the individual does the work. And then I found a quote from Achan Cha, anything which is troubling you, anything which is irritating you, that is your teacher. Which to me is, Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. That's what this is. That's how we tame ourselves. We stay present to each moment, what is arising. Let's see. Oh my goodness. All right. So verses 324, 25, 26. This we're going to talk about a specific elephant. The elephant called Dhanapalaka is hard to control when in rut. Tied down, the tusker doesn't even eat, remembering the elephant forest. The Dhanapalaka elephant is, from what I could find, it is a specific elephant that shows up in a lot of different stories. And it's this elephant's a metaphor for the complexities of our human experience of desire. And it reinforces the idea that mastering one's mind is essential to spiritual progress. Also, in some stories, this is the elephant that people, Devadatta or some others, are set, let loose to try to kill the Buddha because they're ticked off at the Buddha. But the Buddha pacifies this elephant by being completely present with the elephant without fear. The elephant becomes calm. I think of this as an example of how to be with difficult emotions, desires that arise in our minds. And I think I'll run too far out of time. I was going to read to you from Suzuki Roshi's chapter in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the chapter entitled Control, where he says to give your horse or cow a wide pasture. Don't ignore it, but... Oh, don't over-control, and that's how we need to be with our minds. And I'm not going to read that, but I recommend it to you. Find that chapter, the one on control. But it made me think about when I was an elementary school counselor, I would have a lot of children who were, having a lot of trouble, and maybe they were really angry or acting out or whatever. And, well, the teachers in the classroom did have to have a lot of control on them. It was pretty hard. But when they came to my office, my playroom, it was different. And they could find themselves because it was different because I had three rules. They couldn't hurt themselves. They couldn't hurt me, and they couldn't break my toys. Those were my rules. And within that time, we could play, we could meet. I could hear them, I could see them. And they could hear and experience themselves, because we need that. And so then if we take that inwardly, giving ourselves a wide pasture inwardly, sometimes when there are painful or difficult things arising, we need to sit on the cushion and breathe. And for me, I envision my younger self or young self or whatever, and I give it a wide pasture. I hear the anger, the sadness, the not feeling seen, the hurt or whatever, and I let it be, and then gradually I can calm down. I can hold this and be held in the lap of Buddha, and something gets pacified. That's, I think, an important part of taming the mind. So then the next two verses relate to all this. So I'm just going to read them mostly. The sluggish and gluttonous simpleton who sleeps and rolls about like a fat, grain-fed hog is reborn again and again. So I guess the Buddha does want you to really be active. Don't be sluggish. In the past, this mind went wandering where it wished, as it liked, and as it pleased. Now I will retrain it wisely, as an elephant keeper does an elephant in rut. And the only thing I'd add to that is that is at any moment we can choose to enter the path or re-enter. Any moment we feel, you know, it's always there. Okay, now verses 327, 28, 29, and 30. Delight in vigilance. Protect your own mind. Lift yourself from a bad course like a tusker sunk in mud. So really get into that image, okay? Think of a big, heavy elephant in a big mud hole in a river, right? And it's probably been luxuriating there, but it's got to get out and get going. And maybe it's hard, you know? It lifts a leg out and it goes back, and it comes up a little more and goes back. It's like it takes some time. We have to, with ourselves, persevere, be diligent, take care of ourselves with a lot of patience and forbearance. Then the next one, if you find an intelligent companion, a fellow traveler, a sage of good conduct and wise, you should travel together, delighted and mindful, overcoming all dangers. Yeah, good companions help. Sangha helps. But if you do not find an intelligent companion, a fellow traveler of good conduct and wise, travel alone, like a king renouncing a conquered kingdom, like the elephant Matanga in the forest. And in Thanissaro Bhikkhu's footnote on that, he says, the bull elephant named Matanga, reflecting on the inconveniences of living in a herd crowded with she elephants and young elephants, he was pushed around as he went into the river, had to drink muddied water, had to eat leaves that others had already nibbled, decided that he would find more pleasure in living alone. His story parallels that of the elephant in, I don't know this reference, but it's in the Pali Canon, and elephant the Buddha met in the Parilayaka forest. So this is an important teaching. And then the next, I'm going to add in the next verse before I talk a little more about that. It says, there's no companionship with a fool. It is better to go alone. Travel alone at ease, doing no evil like the elephant Matanga in the forest. It's okay to go alone, because we're always centered within ourselves. And I've been thinking about this. We're never alone. When you're centered in that we all inter-are, even with the pebbles or the birds, You may need to go off and get some calm and quiet. But you're not, and so you go alone, but you're with everything. You're with all things. And this story about the Buddha in the forest, well, the monks were all arguing, and they were just driving him crazy because they were arguing with each other and they just couldn't settle. So he left and he went into the forest, which I guess is a dangerous place. But this elephant found him there. And of course, the Buddha is connected with everything. Just greetings, greetings, how are you? I bow to you. And the elephant brought him food and then later brought a monkey along and they kept the tiger away from them and they just had a really good time playing in the river. And eventually, after a number of days, the monks realized the Buddha was not coming back and they better figure things out. And they sorted themselves out and then they went and brought him back. So it's okay to say, no, this situation isn't right for me. I need to leave it. It's okay. The last set of verses, 331 to 333. Happiness is having friends when need arises. Happiness is contentment with whatever there is. Happiness is merit at the end of one's life. Happiness is the abandoning of all suffering. In the world, respect for one's mother is happiness, as is respect for one's father. In the world, respect for renunciants is happiness, as is respect for Brahmins. Happiness is virtue lasting through old age. Happiness is steadfast faith. Happiness is the attainment of wisdom. Not doing evil is happiness, or doing wholesome acts. My comment about this is I think happiness is remembering that we are not separate selves. We inter are with all of creation. When I remember this, I become curious about the other. I looked up a little bit in Dogen's, because I was thinking about it, Genjo Koan and Okamura's, Shohaku Okamura's comments. So you know these phrases. To study the self, the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And then Okamura says, when we study ourselves as the Buddha way, we find that there is no self that is separate from others because the self is connected with all beings. And then, of course, Dogen's last phrase in that is, to forget the self is to be, to be awakened or intimate, I like, with all things. And that then is happiness. And that's the end of our two chapters. So I was going to do a little guided meditation that I have made up for myself about to remind me that I'm connected with everyone. And I go through and I think about the food I've been eating and where it came from and who got it and who planted the seeds and what they ate and all this. And then I also sometimes think of various people in my life, homeless folks around that I see on the street, you know, and just try to bring my sense of interconnection. I think of the trees where I live, stuff like that. That's one thing I do. So your homework, because I want to give the homework before we break into groups. Your homework is see if you can develop some simple practice for yourself that will help you remember that you are not a separate self, that you are interconnected with all beings. So that's the homework. Good luck. And so now I guess, Shufi, we're going to want to be in small groups. And the question for the small groups is talk about whatever, you know, sparked you during, whatever arose during the talk. you know? Maybe one thing made sense and the rest of it didn't, so talk about what made sense. Or if something really sounded crazy and off, talk about that. Or if you want to further question, if you feel like sharing about it, what sort of hells are you aware of? How would you give them physical description? So that's some possibilities. Really, you can talk about whatever you need to. And Shufi, let's see, we've got maybe groups of 3 minutes each, and then another minute. Does that work? And I don't even see Shufi. Where is she?
That works great.
There you are. Now I see you. Good. Okay, so if you would send people off, thank you.